Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22, 22 minutes of science, interviews, and great music. I'm Jorge Salazar. This week, the Mayan calendar and doomsday prophecies. Is the world approaching peak water? And evidence that chivalry isn't dead in insects. Here's a scientist soundbite.
2012 is a phenomena that came about through different kinds of grassroots spiritual movements and some interpretation of Maya writing that happened prior to really understanding what the glyphs were saying.
That was Catherine Reese Taylor, a professor of Maya archaeology. More with her later, but first, here's Science News of the Week with Emily Howard and Michael Brennan.
On October 6th, an international team of researchers presented new findings about the planet Uranus and how it got its tilt. The scientists announced their findings at a meeting of planetary astronomers in France. Most planets in our solar system spin nearly upright with respect to the plane of their orbits around the Sun. But Uranus spins sideways. It has a spin axis of 98 degrees. Using simulations, the team figured out that at least two small collisions with space debris might have knocked Uranus into its current orientation billions of years ago.
Earlier this month, an international team of researchers announced in the science journal Nature an ozone hole opened in the northern Arctic in spring of 2011. Earth's protective ozone has been threatened for decades. It's expected to recover, but warming temperatures on Earth are thought to be slowing its recovery.
On October 7th, scientists from Arizona State University and Johns Hopkins University presented a new map of the Moon, made with images from the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter camera. They say the map reveals the presence of titanium on the Moon, which might give us more clues to the composition of the Moon's interior.
On October 6th, scientists from the University of Exeter revealed in the online journal Current Biology that male and female crickets work cooperatively after mating. After viewing around 200,000 hours of footage of crickets in the wild, the researchers found that male crickets stick around after mating with females. Until now, researchers believed male crickets were simply trying to stop females from taking more partners. But this new evidence caused them to believe males hang around after mating to protect females from predators.
On October 11th, the XPRIZE Foundation awarded $1.3 million to two companies, Elastic American Marine and NOFI, for developing new technology to clean up oil spills. The foundation launched an oil cleanup challenge in July of 2010 as a response to the Deepwater Horizon oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. Contestants were challenged to create technology that could recover oil at a rate greater than 2,500 gallons per minute. That's 9,464 liters per minute.
More than 600 people were evacuated from the Canary Islands off the coast of North Africa on October 11th and 12th after two undersea volcanic eruptions near a populated coastline. The eruptions occurred near Spain's El Hierro Island, the smallest and most volcanically active island in the Canaries. By October 13th, local geophysicists in the Canary Islands were saying the threat had eased, and they were determining whether the undersea volcanic vent was widening, and if so, whether it was widening in the direction of land. I'm Michael Brennan.
And I'm Emily Howard. Science interviews, up next.
We'd love to hear from you on Facebook. Tell us where you're from. Find us as Earth Sky. The year 2012 has become a phenomenon of sorts, with widely circulated doomsday prophecies, supposedly coming from writings made by ancient Mayan people who lived in what's now Mexico and Central America. On the line to talk about 2012 doomsday prophecies and what archaeologists know is Catherine Reese Taylor, professor of Mayan archaeology at the University of Calgary in Canada. Dr. Reese Taylor, welcome.
Thank you.
Now tell us some, what are the important facts that people should know about 2012 and the Mayan calendar?
Well, I think that what people should know about 2012 is that it is a date that is basically something that we created in the West, that the Maya did not predict the end of the world or even a huge transformation in the way that we're conceiving of it today. 2012 is a phenomena that came about through different kinds of grassroots spiritual movements and some interpretation of Maya writing that happened prior to really understanding what the glyphs were saying. It's an interesting phenomena, but there is no archaeological basis for this phenomena, and the Maya calendar does not really predict it ending in 2012.
Many people seem to be pointing to an ancient carving called the Tortuguero Monument 6 as being a source of prophecies about this this year that supposedly has a lot of significance, 2012. Tell us more about this carving. What do scientists know about it, and what does it say?
Tortuguero Monument 6 is a monument that was carved during the late Classic period, which is from approximately 600 to 800 AD. And the monument has probably around 80 glyphs, 80 different phrases or words or sentences on the monument. So it's quite a long inscription. The very final 8 glyphs of the monument literally are the only ones that deal with the future date, 2012, in any real way. Of the hundreds of inscriptions that we have from the Maya area, those particular glyphs say that this date, which happens to be a date in the Maya long count, 13000, will happen. And on that day, this particular deity will descend, because he is the patron deity of something called period endings. Period endings are long cycles of time that end. So the Maya have a Catun, which is 20 years and is kind of like our decade, and they certainly have these 400-year periods, of which one is ending on December 21st, 2012. And this patron deity is going to descend because he is the patron deity that's going to oversee all the ceremonies that happen on this particular day. That is all that the Maya say about 2012 on December 21st.
Did you leave out the part about the end of the world?
No, because they actually didn't say that. Nowhere did the Maya say at any point in time that the world will end. They don't even say that their calendar will end and that it's going to restart. The Maya and many inscriptions talk about dates far into the future. They have a date that is at 4772 AD, more than twice as far ahead of us as 2012 is from our year one. So they have long, long periods of time in the future, and they do not conceive of the world ending or even the calendar restarting at that time. So the Maya really didn't concern themselves with this date nearly as much as we do now in the 21st century.
You've said that there are real effects the 2012 phenomenon has had on people living today in Latin America. Would you like to tell us what you meant by that?
Well, I think that you can't look at these doomsday prophecies and not think back to the Hale-Bopp comet period, where so many people believed that the Hale-Bopp comet was going to come along and there were aliens in the comet and they all committed suicide in order to be raptured up to the comet and taken away. There certainly is that kind of doomsday prophecy and those kinds of belief systems that are trickling their way into Latin America as well. And the Maya today have access to computers and the World Wide Web, and they also have TV and satellite TV and cable, And all of the different kinds of documentaries that we're seeing on the Discovery Channel are also translated into Spanish and shown in Latin America. And so people are trying to look at everything that's going on in particularly North America and understand it in terms of their own worldview. So different religious leaders are incorporating aspects of the 2012 prophecies into their teaching in some very interesting ways. I have run across different religious leaders in the Maya area who believe that aliens are going to return, that there are going to be people from the Pleiades coming back, and that they are going to help us, enlighten us, and elevate us to a new level of consciousness. I don't think there's anything wrong with elevating the consciousness of the planet, but I do think that there is some kind of dangers in projecting this notion of aliens returning, asteroids returning and hitting the Earth. So I think it's important for science to clearly speak up and say there are no asteroids headed for the Earth. There is no Jupiter-sized planet that is hurtling towards us. We have way bigger things to worry about with what we're doing to the planet than to be scared of any of these doomsday prophecies coming true.
You've been listening to archaeologist Dr. Catherine Rees-Taylor of the University of Calgary in Canada. We'd love to hear from you on Facebook. Tell us where you're from. Find us as Earth Sky. That was Birthday by Dana Falconberry from her album Hallets. Beth Lebwohl is here with an interview with scientist Peter Glick on water challenges the world faces today. Welcome, Beth.
Hey, thank you, Jorge. So on October 18th, the Pacific Institute, which is a water think tank in California, is coming out with a new report on the state of the world's water resources, especially in the face of climate change. The report will be called The World's Water. And in honor of the release of that report, we're bringing you an interview I had with the head of the Pacific Institute, Dr. Peter Glick, in the spring of 2011. So I wanted to talk to you today about the concept of peak water. What is it?
Well, many people are more familiar with the idea of peak oil. That is, the idea that eventually countries or regions or the world as a whole will experience a peak in the production of a non-renewable resource like oil. We'll find it increasingly difficult to find more oil, will be more expensive to obtain, and we will peak in our production. So peak water is both similar and different to the idea of peak oil. Water, of course, as most people know, is a renewable resource. But we'd like to argue, and some colleagues of mine and I at the Pacific Institute have written a paper about this, that in fact we are approaching peak water in many different senses of the term.
Okay, and I think therein lies the paradox, at least in my mind. I think to myself, you know, even after having heard you talk about it, I think, you know, I still don't really understand how for something like water, which, you know, it replenishes itself, how we can max out on it. I don't actually understand.
Well, that's a great question. How can we have peak water or peak anything if it's a renewable resource? And here's the answer. First of all, not all water is renewable. There are stocks of water, mostly groundwater, that are non-renewable, exactly like oil. And so the first definition is peak non-renewable water. Just like oil, there are stocks of water on the planet that we are using faster than nature recharges them. And we can do that for a while, but it's not sustainable. And by some estimates, as much as 40% of the water that humans use come from non-renewable resources like northern China groundwater or groundwater in the Central Valley of California or in the Great Plains of the United States or groundwater in India. Any place where we're pumping groundwater much faster than nature recharges it is a non-renewable resource. And we are already seeing peak non-renewable water limits being reached in many parts of the world. And so that's the first challenge. For water resources that are renewable, there's a different kind of limit. And that is what we call peak renewable limits. So if you look at a river is a renewable resource. The amount we use today doesn't affect how much nature delivers tomorrow or next year. It's renewable. It's part of the hydrologic cycle. But the limit is we cannot use more than the river flow itself. Even if we take all of the flow of the river, there are limits. And in more and more parts of the planet, the Colorado River, the Yellow River, the Nile, we are reaching peak renewable limits. That is, we can no longer use any more water than the Colorado River provides, and we're using it all. And that's a renewable limit as well.
Is it like people, we're taking all of the river's water? Is that what you're saying? Is that actually physically happening?
Yes, that's exactly right. So for the Colorado River, and it doesn't matter whether it's dammed or not dammed, but the Colorado is dammed, but there's an average flow of any river. And it goes up and down. We have wet years, we have dry years, but there's an average flow. For a river like the Colorado or the Nile or the Yellow in China, humans are now taking the entire flow of the river, and no water reaches the mouth of the Colorado River anymore, except in a really, really wet year. No more water is reaching the mouth of the Nile anymore because humans are using it all. So that's a peak renewable limit. We might like more water from the Colorado River Basin, but we can't have any more because we're using it all.
Ah, I see. Okay. And isn't there a third component to this?
Yes. In the work that we've done on peak water, there is a third constraint that I think is really important, and we call it peak ecological water. And that's the point where the next gallon of water that we take out of a system, a river or a lake or a wetland or whatever, causes more ecological harm than it provides economic benefit. In other words, When we first start to take water out of a system and use it to grow food or make semiconductors or use it for residential use, it provides a benefit to society. It also causes a little bit of ecological harm. And at first, we don't pay much attention to that. But we are now reaching a point, and I would argue we've passed the point in many hydrologic basins, of what we call peak ecological water, where we now are causing more damage with every unit of water we take, ecological damage typically, than we're providing economic benefit. And it's very hard to measure that point, but it's a reality. And that point we call peak ecological water.
Earth Sky's Beth Lebwohl. And that's our show. Thank you for joining us. This week's show was recorded at the Earth Sky Studios in Austin, Texas, live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers are Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Bird. Our audio engineer is Eddie Campos. And special thanks this week to our musical contributors, Mother Falcon, Sleep Good, Dana Falconberry, 100 Flowers, and The Black and White Years. For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next stage. There are so many artists, too much heart, and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next stage. But what we don't know won't hurt us. What we don't know won't keep us alive.